Hello and welcome to another episode of the Foxhole Companion with me, Dan Stewart.
And me, Simon Rance.
The podcast that brings you the chronological history of the Second World War seen through the silver screen. And boy, have we got a winner for you today. Hey? Hey?
Oh, yeah.
What are you laughing at?
No.
Probably the greatest film ever made.
Oh, yeah. Is it? It's not the worst film ever made.
It's not Confessions of a Nazi Spy.
No, it isn't Confessions of a Nazi Spy, thank God.
But it was the most successful film in the UK in 1940. Simon's got a theory about that. We'll get to it.
I've only just heard that from Dan, which I couldn't quite believe.
And you looked it up, didn't you? I was right.
Went through the notes and he was completely right. I can only think is that in 1940, no one was daring to go to the cinema due to air raids. So it was the only cinema that was open. And it turns out it was on a double bill with The Saint. So that's how well thought of it was. Upon its premiere.
Oh, Lord.
It was premiered as a double bill with The Saint.
That sounds like an amazing night out.
So the fact that The Saint was even less successful than Convoy says that that episode of The Saint franchise is dearly one to miss. But anyway, Convoy.
Convoy.
It's a 1940 movie.
Not the 1978 film with Kris Kristofferson and Ally McGraw.
Directed by Sam Peckinpah.
We got a mighty convoy rocking all through the night. Do you remember that? Do you remember everyone had a CB radio and it was like...
Rubber duck.
Yeah. There's a bear in the air and all of that stuff.
Yeah. So yeah,
we're not doing that.
We're doing Convoy, made in 1940, from Ealing Studios. So that means it was produced by Michael Balkan, who we'll talk about in a bit once Dan's done his pocket history. It was also directed by Penn Tennyson. We'll talk about him. It stars Clive Brook. We'll talk about him.
When I first saw the name Penn Tennyson, I thought he was the guy from Penn and Teller. I was like, God, he's aged well.
Oh, he's really good at magic and can go back in time to star in a film that nobody else wanted to be in. John Clements, we'll talk about him, and Judy Campbell. So yeah, that's all my notes. Now, for the next half an hour, while I fall asleep, Convoy's on.
What do you mean, now you fall asleep? You've been yawning for the last half hour.
Oh, I've had a day.
He's had a big day, bless him. Ladies and gents, Convoy was filmed in 1940, and it is probably, I would say, the first film to try and capture what became known as the Battle of the Atlantic, which was the naval campaign that lasted from the outbreak of war in 1939 to the Nazi surrender in 1945. The largest and longest naval campaign in history. Yeah. Obviously covering just millions of square miles of open water. The problem that the British were facing at the outbreak of war in 1939 and the start of the phony war and then into the war proper in 1940 was that we're a tiny island and we don't make anything now. We did make quite a bit then in terms of raw materials, but even then we relied on huge amounts of imports in order to just function day to day. The amount of materials we needed to survive as a country at war was enormous, was huge. And basically, the battle for the Atlantic, the Battle of the Atlantic, was a tonnage war. It was just one side trying to sink as many ships containing raw materials as possible, and the other side trying to stop it. Britain required at the outbreak of war more than 1 million tons of imported material per week to keep its military functioning. It's an oft overlooked part of the Second World War, which is odd because almost none of the Second World War would have happened had the Allies lost the Battle of the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. The only reason that Britain could keep fighting was because of the vast quantities of stuff that America was sending over by ships. Of course, you couldn't do a plane in those days. It is covered in quite a few films that we will eventually look at. Amazing films. such as The Cruel Sea, The Enemy Below, Sink the Bismarck, The Amazing Das Boot, the 1981 German film, all of which deal with the Battle of the Atlantic. But as far as I know, made in 1940, this is the first film to try and capture this epic battle on a scale that was not seen ever again. And boy, does it do it, Simon. That's all I've got to say, really, because there's nothing else to say. Obviously, the two sides involved are the Allies of Great Britain, the Royal Navy, the Canadian Navy, which was obviously part of Britain back then. Sorry, Canada. But yeah, you were British back then. And the American Navy, although obviously the American Navy, the US Navy, didn't get involved militarily until late 1941, very late 1941. Thanks, lads, for helping out.
God, that's the listenership gone.
There's America gone.
We've just lost Canada, we've just lost the US.
Versus the Kriegsmarine, which is the German Navy, the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, and what was the Italian Navy? I laugh because...
Marina Militare.
Si.
They got wicked uniforms.
They looked amazing. You know what I love? Americans won't know this reference, but in the late 80s, there was, well, mid-80s, there was a brilliant British sitcom called Allo Allo about French resistance.
Was that brilliant?
It was so good, mate.
Oh, my God.
Don't you dare. Just put it this way. In today's society, it would never have been made.
No.
It was basically full of jokes about boobies.
Yeah.
And gratuitously, awfully generalised, stereotypical portrayals of French and Germans.
Plus one Italian.
And that's what I was going to say.
Right.
So the one Italian in it has this amazing uniform with all this braid and brocade on, doesn't he?
This fantastic feather.
Yeah, and a massive feather in his hat. They had great uniforms, the Italians, and that's about it.
Just quickly regarding Marina Militare.
So here we go.
The Italian naval base is actually in Livorno.
Yeah.
At the port of Livorno, which is bizarre because Livorno is the anarchist and communist city of Italy. If not of Western
Europe.
I know,
so how did they manage to get...
Well, it was the open city, so it was full of trade, obviously, being a port city. It became very left-wing due to it being an open city to Jews, Muslims. Anyone and everyone were allowed to trade there.
Sounds like an amazing place.
It is, and the food is incredible. But the Italian Navy are there.
And weird. Simon and I are going to do some quote-unquote research in Livorno in January, aren't we?
We are, yeah.
So these two mighty nations basically had at it across the vast frozen wastes of the North Atlantic. I mean, if you want to be conducting a naval campaign, South Pacific sounds great.
Yeah,
North Atlantic, whoa.
More sharks, though. Surely.
That's true.
And also, like... If you think about it, the Atlantic, and then if you can creep in via Felixstowe into the North Sea, you can always stop off at Yarmouth.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Your mission...
A seaman's paradise, as they say.
And I bet they do. Simon's sort of cynical, secret mission of this podcast is to try and get in... A plug for Norfolk.
It's a Norfolk propagandist, that's what I am. Imagine if Yarmouth had a navy now. That would be a film.
Thank Christ.
The Herring Bashers. should we talk about Convoy the film then?
Yeah. Okay. No, we've got one last bit to say.
Okay.
So some of the most famous battleships of the German Navy were involved in the battle for the Atlantic. The Bismarck, the Scharnhorst, the Tirpitz, and the Deutschland, the battleship that is actually the bad guy in this film. By the end of the war, the casualties and losses on both sides during the battle for the Atlantic were on the Allied side 36,200 sailors killed, 36,000 merchant seamen killed, which, if you think about it, that's terrifying. That's, I mean, horrible. These poor guys were basically running the gauntlet across the North Atlantic in these convoys, unarmed, basically carrying this incredibly vital materials for the war. Mm. And the fact that 36,000 merchant seamen lost their lives shows you how hard the Germans hit those convoys. There were 3,500 merchant vessels sunk, 175 Allied warships were lost, and 741 RAF planes were lost. On the German Axis side, 30,000 U-boat sailors were killed, 783 submarines were lost, and 47 other warships, and 17 Italian submarines. The entire battle for the Atlantic was basically Allied surface ships trying to avoid and detect German submarines. And the German U-boat threat was significant. I mean, those wolf packs of German submarines could have turned the war as significantly as fighter pilots for the Allies in the Battle of Britain did. So much so, Winston Churchill was quoted as saying, "The only thing that really frightened me during the war was the U-boat peril. I was even more anxious about this battle than I had been about the glorious air fight called the Battle of Britain." So that just puts in perspective for the commanders and the leaders of the Allied forces of how precarious this trade route between America and Europe was, and how fiercely fought it was, and the cost.
I'm sure he wasn't just cacking it as much as the merchant seamen who actually go into the sea in a big thing which weighed about 500 tons and being shot at. While he's at home with a champagne and his trotters up, I reckon they had it a bit harder.
Having said that, if you take the characterizations of the merchant seamen in our film Convoy, they were having a grand old time. They were perky, chirpy seamen.
Well, that's the thing. If we do turn to the film now...
Yes, please, let's do that.
It is an Ealing movie made in 1940, produced by Michael Borkum, which of course means it is a slice of propaganda. Now, some of the propaganda that Ealing Studios were pumping out at the time, excuse me, was absolutely tremendous. Some of it was too on the nose, and I'd say this one's a bit too on the nose, but it is what it is, right? So, for example, Borkum's Ealing Studios had put out Dead of Night, had put out The Halfway House at a very similar time. Now, those two movies are horror movies of sorts, but they're also very, very intelligent pieces of propaganda and very, very subtle for their time. Now, this is a full-on battle of a film.
It's a war film.
Yeah, so therefore, it is on the nose. Now, there are parts of it which are genuinely exciting, and there are parts of it which are like, so British, it's like it's almost taking the piss. It's a 1940s British film, and that is the best way to describe it. But a quick thing about the people behind the film. It's directed by a chap called Penn Tennyson, right, who has only made, I believe, three movies. And this was his last one. He was killed, actually. He was killed in an aircraft crash serving in the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
Which is pretty, pretty tragic.
And he's sort of considered to have been one of the most promising directors of his time.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about some of the performances in this, because they do range from the utterly eccentric, I mean, we're talking about old world Ealing comedy sort of performances.
Oh yeah, for sure.
To some things that even Simon and I were like, you know what, that's actually not bad.
Yeah, absolutely.
But now, tell us more about the...
Penn Tennyson... One of his, also released in 1940, was a film he did, very socialist movie for Ealing Studios, starring Paul Robeson.
Right.
So it's filmed in South Wales Coldfield. It's called The Proud Valley. Now, obviously, Paul Robeson likes a bit of a sing-song, and as far as Ealing Studios are concerned, as do all Welsh people. And there's a lot...
I can't believe you've reduced The Proud Valley, you know, this incredible film starring one of the most sort of dynamic, political characters of Hollywood as a film about a good sing-song.
Of someone who I have great respect for. But my point is that that's a pretty edgy number for 1940. You know, Paul Rosen is a chap who was a full-on Soviet sympathiser. And
he would have been blacklisted in Hollywood, wouldn't he?
Yes, absolutely. So he was The Proud Valley is not your average Ealing movie by any stretch of the imagination. So what I'm trying to say about Bolton and Ealing Studios is that, yes, they would put out some on-the-nose propaganda like this, but it was also a very, very productive talent house studio. And some of the stuff, I mean, obviously we go through later stuff, the Guinness stuff, like such as the Lady Killers and things like that, the Lavender Hill Mob.
Hmm.
When you're talking about
all those Alec Guinness films.
Yeah, you're talking about the Ealing comedies. But prior to that, it was already a powerhouse of a studio in Little Britain, as powerful as a powerhouse in Ealing can be.
Just to go back, because I've not seen this and I really want to now. I'm sort of in awe of the fact that in the late 30s, Ealing Studios made a film with Paul Robeson about an African-American miner in a coal mine in Wales, basically fighting corruption and trying to start a union. Now,
it's all very Marxist.
I love that. I mean, I can't believe. And here's the really interesting thing. And it actually may not be a surprise to many of you who are British, is that the film didn't do very well. And should I tell you, Simon, why the film didn't do very well? Because Max Aitken, the first Baron Beaverbrook, think a combination of Rupert Maxwell and Murdoch in one human being. He owned the most successful newspaper in Britain at the time, the Daily Express, and he was as right-wing as you could get.
What, from the Daily Express?
It's astonishing, I know, and hard to believe. And by the way, he supported appeasement. He was all about just surrender to the Nazis right now, and God knows what his other plans were. It doesn't even bear thinking about. But he didn't like Paul Robeson's politics, so he basically, imagine, I don't know what the equivalent would be, imagine if Fox News refused to commentate on, I don't know, a Marvel film.
Right.
They would just be like, no, blacklisted, we will not even mention this film.
So you just don't even acknowledge it exists.
And it basically bombed the film. Okay. So, we've had our fair share of, and he wasn't even British either. It's just like Murdoch. He was bloody Canadian. So thanks for that, Canada, as well.
Cut. Right. And then let's talk about the lead.
Yes.
Clive Brook or Clifford Hardman Brook. I like the name. He's called Hardman.
That's Hardman
Brook. I mean, you don't expect him to be the toff that he is in this with a name like that. You expect him to be an Aussie inmate.
It's a great...
Hardman Brook. Anyway, he was born in Islington, which is home to the greatest football club the world has ever seen.
Oh, my Lord.
And he died in Ealing, probably on a movie. Not this one. He lived to a decent age of 87.
Did he?
Yeah. He studied at Dulwich College, so he's probably a bit posh.
Well...
Could you tell he was posh?
Listen, I really highly recommend that people... Because I actually do... A little backstory before we get started on the nitty-gritty of this film. Simon and I have seen this film twice now. The trouble was, the first time we watched it in a double bill.
No, we watched it in a quadruple bill.
Oh,
it was our first night.
It was our very, very first night of watching films for this podcast.
And we were so excited. We said, oh, let's watch four.
And we had quite a few beers, didn't we, Simon?
Well, I think the problem came is when you got the whiskey out.
I got the whiskey out, and the trouble was... We watched The Seventh Cross. We watched Confessions of a Nazi Spy.
Yeah.
And then we watched this. And I'm ashamed to say, dear listeners, I couldn't remember it. I literally couldn't remember anything about the film. So much to Simon's horror.
He definitely doesn't remember watching The Dirty Dozen afterwards.
No, that I don't remember that. I don't even remember it coming on. Much to Simon's horror, I said, well, we've got to watch it again. And...
We did.
Thanks. Go on, then.
Right, so Clive Brook, right, who plays the skipper. Now, as I said, he's born in Islington. Now, he served in the First World War, right? He was in the Artists' Rifles, which sounds to me like a load of actors and stagehands from vaudeville, armed to the teeth, darling.
How has no one made a sitcom about that?
Oh, the Artist's Rifles. Now, I might be...
We had Ain't Half Hot Mum about the, you know, the performing troupe in the British Army in the Far East.
Exactly.
Why haven't we done this? The Artist's Rifles is amazing.
It's just a name which I haven't researched, okay? So they might have been like a crack commando like the SAS.
Crack!
I don't know.
A crack troop of actors.
Yeah.
And artists and poets.
I thought you were wonderful as a Iago. Yeah.
The way you stormed those battlements was absolutely marvellous, dear boy. It reminded me of Olivier in Henry V.
So anyway, his story's quite interesting, so bear with. So yeah.
Go on.
So he fought in the First World War. He was also a journalist. And really exciting news, he was an insurance clerk at some point. But
weren't we all, darling?
So he first appeared on the stage in 1918.
Yes.
And then in films from 1919. Okay. Now, but the... very interesting thing about him is that actually he was quite a star of the silent era in Hollywood.
Oh.
He was a Paramount player.
Was he now?
Yeah. He's been... Oh, dear God, his filmography is humongous, as you can imagine. I mean, I'm just looking at it here. In 1921, he made 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. He made 7 films in 1921. I mean, he's being pumped around the studio lot, so to speak.
As you do.
10 movies in 1922. I mean, he's at Paramount. He's been in movies with Marlene Dietrich, etc., etc., etc. And then he came back, and when he transferred quite well into talkies.
Yep.
And then he came back to Britain. And joined Ealing. And
you know what?
This was one of his last films.
It's unsurprising to me because there was something, not knowing that, while I was watching it, he's filmed in a different way to everyone else. Almost through, you know how they, in the 70s and 60s, they used to film the ingenue through sort of Vaseline, put Vaseline on the lens or
yes,
gauze
yes,
in front,
yes,
to yes, soft focus, as it's known,
yeah.
Is... he had this very sort of matte white makeup. There was something very silent film about him.
Right, okay.
The way he looked.
I get you. So his co-star, or really the second billing actor, is...
I mean, I would call him the lead.
Yeah, I get what you mean. But obviously, Hardman Brooke drew a bigger crowd.
John Clements doesn't even have his picture in IMDb, you know.
Really?
No.
Well, Sir John Selby Clements.
Ooh, was he knighted?
CBE.
Oh.
British actor and producer, right? Mm. I believe he also did some playwriting, but he's mainly based, mainly in the theatre, did very few films, really.
And he's playing Lieutenant Cranford, the Bounder.
Yeah, so he's a... I haven't got much on him, I'm afraid.
That's
apart
all right.
From his final film...
Go on.
...was Top Secret.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that's legendary.
Uncredited.
Oh.
As an East German dignitary.
To think this man's career spanned from Convoy in 1940.
He's in a good World War II movie. I'm not saying this isn't good, but he's in a good World War II movie about Yugoslavia.
What's that called?
That's called Undercover.
Well, we'll do that then.
That was made in 1943.
Ooh.
Yeah.
It is so funny. I mean, it's worth saying, isn't it, Simon, that we're talking about 1940 Britain here. So this was probably filmed during the height of the Battle of Britain. Britain was as deeply into the World War II as it could be. And the British film industry, just like almost every other industry in Britain, was switching from peacetime to wartime. And the fact that they were putting out films like this as pieces of propaganda, basically. I mean, wait till we don't get us started on the Germans. Wait till we get to the Germans in this film. Blimey. Simon and I have a very long list for stereotypical Nazi award in this. But that's basically what it is, isn't it, Simon? It's propaganda.
It's total propaganda.
Yeah.
I've spoken about Penn 10, the director.
Penn Tennyson, I also want to add to that, was a protege of...
Oh, Hitchcock.
Of Hitchcock. That's and right. He was Hitchcock's assistant director on quite a few incredibly famous Hitchcock films, like The 39 Steps,
well, that's
The Man Who Knew Too Much, Secret Agent, Sabotage. And he was sort of considered to be this real prospect.
Oh, for sure. And that would have all been organised by Balkan, who oversaw a lot of and championed a lot of Hitchcock's early career.
Mm. I mean, I think it's really interesting that this man, who unfortunately died in a wartime accident, his two films are this Convoy, which is a piece of propaganda, but we'll get to it. I think there are moments in this which are kind of beyond your typical Ealing propaganda. And The Proud Valley, I think he would have had a very interesting career had he lived.
Yeah, no, I agree. Lastly, I want to talk about the actress Judy Campbell.
Come on, then.
Now, she's really interesting as well.
And good as well, isn't
she?
She's
very, very good. So she was an English actress and a playwright, again, and widely known to be Noel Coward's muse.
That's got to be all right, isn't it?
Well, I mean, yeah. Who was also, of course, blacklisted by the Daily Express.
Yeah, oh, yeah. He also got Beaverbrook's ire because in his film...
In Which We Serve?
Yes, In Which We Serve. The opening frame of In Which We Serve is a copy of the Daily Express floating in a muddy piece of water saying, "War will not break out." Which was Lord Beaverbrook hoping that he could all be a Nazi with the rest of them.
Good on him.
So, and yeah.
Judy Campbell's daughter is Jane Birkin.
Amazing.
Yeah. And not only that, I mean, it's like a who's who.
Yeah, go on, give us that list again. It's incredible.
Her son was the screenwriter and director, Andrew Birkin. Among her grandchildren are the actresses Charlotte Gainsbourg.
Amazing.
Anno Birkin, the artist David Birkin, photographer Kate Barry, and, of course, that...
Although you mentioned John Barry,
her
too.
Her son-in-law is the composer John Barry.
Which is... Wow.
I know. That is pretty mad,
and
isn't it?
I think she's quite good in this.
She is good. And this is quite important.
Go on.
She was from Grantham, Lincolnshire, okay, where...
I'm ready for this. Okay. Go on.
Her family was acquainted with another famous family from Grantham in Lincolnshire.
Yeah.
The Thatchers, Margaret Thatcher. I don't think they were closest mates, because if she was hanging with Noel Coward, I can't imagine her being too much of a major...
If she was with Penn Tennyson making films with outspoken communist...
Well, not only
Paul
that,
Robeson, but
she was an actress, right? She was of the arts. She's not going to be a staunch Tory, was she? Anyway, we shouldn't keep talking about politics because
we're losing
the US. We would have lost Italy after talking about Marina Militare.
And we've lost Canada, and we've lost half of Britain.
But during the war, she was famous for entertaining the troops and people during air raids. So she would, where is it? German street theatre and cabaret performances with Law's Piccadilly Dance Orchestra, and most memorably for a Coward centenary concert at the Queen Elizabeth Hall in 1999. She regaled the audience often with hilarious anecdotes about her work with Coward during the 1940s and sang her version of Nightingale. Now, she was... This is quite cool. You know the Chelsea Arts Club? Of course you do. You're an actor.
I've been there loads of times.
Anyway, so she bought a place right next to the Chelsea Arts Club in 1974 so she could hang there all the time, and did so up until her death in 2004.
Why not? You get a favourite pub, you want to live next to it.
Yeah, she did loads of troop concerts with Noel Coward, cheering up West End punters during the Blitz in London, including unique renderings of a Nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. This made her a star at the New Faces Review at the Comedy Theatre. Wow. Now known as the Noel Coward Theatre, which is the last time I saw you on stage.
Now known as the Harold Pinter Theatre.
Oh, right, sorry.
Yeah, it was the Coward, and then it was the Pinter, now it's the Pinter. Yeah, so, oh, we've trod the same boards, her and I.
Indeed. Well, so have I, to be fair, because you let me go on the stage.
I did, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this other great names in this we have for a reappearance from his appearance in The Way Ahead, John Laurie.
Yeah.
That those British amongst our listeners will know him as the pessimistic doom and gloom merchant.
We're doomed.
We're doomed, Mr. Mannering.
From Dad's Army.
From Dad's Army. Who, as we explained before, was a very notable actor in his own right and was often seen with the likes of Laurence Olivier and John Gielgud, and was a bit miffed that he was basically only known as "We're doomed, Mr. Manning."
You'd be gutted, wouldn't you?
You'd be so gutted. So he's in this, and he's got quite a big part in this as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We also have names that may be familiar to some of those who were... you know, movie buffs, Mervyn Johns. Hey,
well, Mervyn Johns is a wonderful actor. So he was also another stalwart of the Ealing studio.
Yeah.
So he's in Dead of Night.
That's right.
He's also in The Halfway House.
Yeah. We have the likes of Stuart Granger, who was a sort of matinee idol. And... Simon, how excited were we? Uncredited.
Oh, yes.
As U-boat officer, it's our best friend, Anton Driffing again.
Anton Driffing again. So he is going to win. I mean, whether he'll win the entire competition of being in the most films, he will be the most recognisable Nazi.
And
for
he might win the overall most stereotypical Nazi.
Yeah.
For those of you who are going, scratching your heads, going, where did I hear that name before? You'll remember him from as the snooty Luftwaffe officer in Reach for the Sky, the Kenneth Moore film. But Simon and I love him because, Simon, he is also...
in Where Eagles Dare.
Oh. And basically, if you were in Eagles Dare, we will get on our hands and knees.
Well, you've made
and
it. You've made it.
That's it. You're top of our list.
Yeah.
So there we go. So let's talk about this film. Oh, come on. We've got
haven't
to do
it.
We
just done that?
That not enough.
Oh,
not enough
God.
For a piece of work that as brilliant as this.
Okay.
The plot of this film is really, really simple.
Basic. Is it?
It is so simple.
No, I think it should be, but they make it convoluted by the hijacking of a ship, the bizarre love triangle. They try and make it complicated because it is so quite dull.
The love triangle is weird because it is very not 1940s. It's a bit more 1960s, if you ask me, and we'll get to that. Basically, we have a British cruiser, a light cruiser, that is manned by your very stereotypical below deck sailors. Ooh, right, Gaffnag, where's the grub up?
One who looks like Tim Roth.
Oh, God, he does. Yeah. There's one actor that is, if he's not related to Tim Roth, I don't know what. And, you know, you've got your chirpy Cockney sailor and you've got your grumpy, horrible Cockney sailor and you've got your sloshing out the chow Cockney actor. They're all in it. And then upstairs in the officer's room, we've got a frightful amount of...
That's what was so strange.
Is Simon and I kept having to stop the film and go, what did he say? Because you can understand all the below decks chirpy Cockney chaps.
Of course you can.
But when it comes to the officer's room, you don't bloody understand what word is saying.
It's like, how much of a cucumber sandwich do they have in their mouth? You can't hear what they're saying. The dialogue is inaudible.
You know what I'd like to do? Hop on my little bus, fly her straight to town, pancake her on top of the Ritz, and make a parachute drop straight through into the American bar. With rows and rows of gleaming little bottles and fairy lights all twinkling through them. And instead of Peacock's ugly old mug leering at you over a couple of pink gins, there'd be a wonderful Popsy. With a full set of everything. Bottoms up.
Here we go.
That's so posh!
And it's so ridiculous, because they're on a bloody ship.
You should be able to communicate.
Well, not only that, you'd be shouting, wouldn't you, if you're outside on the Atlantic.
Not when you're bloody eating studios, right? Just put the sherry in my dressing room. I'll come to it later.
Bizarre.
So this light cruiser filled with cheery chaps and very posh officers gets a new recruit who rocks up in a convertible chauffeur-driven limo with his...
He's a right dandy.
With his bird. And she's like, darling, I do hope you'll be careful. And he's like, you know me, darling, I'm always careful. And this is our dashing hero.
David Cranford.
David Cranford, Lieutenant Cranford, John Clements. And we can tell he's a bit of a dandy because he's got like a tailored officer's uniform. And he comes on deck and gets immediately taken in to see the captain, who is not pleased to see him.
No.
And we find out why he's not pleased to see him is because, according to the ship gossip, Lieutenant Cranford seduced Captain Armitage's wife somewhere in the South Seas, Singapore or somewhere, ran away with her and then dumped her in Singapore and left without her. That's the scuttlebutt on the ship.
That is.
And so the whole crew go from being, well, he seems like a jolly fine fellow, he's a great addition to the officer's mess, to being like, sorry, we don't want anything to do with you. Mm-hmm. And he's treated very poorly.
He is.
Which he takes with pure...
He takes it on the chin, doesn't he?
He takes it on the chin. Oh, well, that's fine if you don't want to speak to me or give me a sherry or whatever.
I don't think it's cricket, but it'll have to do.
With a sense of humour, shall we say. Anyway, he's been assigned to this particular cruiser. There's nought to be done about it. The captain's like, first chance I get, I'm getting into port and having you sent to another ship. And he's like, that will be fabulous for both of us. Very good. It's frosty.
Yeah, it's frosty.
It's a frosty atmosphere between the two.
Yeah.
Having said that, Lieutenant Cranford gets shown to his room, which looks like a suite at the Savoy.
Oh, it looks great.
I mean, he's...
It looks better than Captain Tom's.
Yeah, the captain's suite is quite sort of military, you know. It's all sort of bulkheads and things like that. Cranford is basically by himself in a suite that looks... I mean, if you put that on P&O cruises, you'd be well chuffed, wouldn't you?
Oh, no.
You checked in for your cruise up the Nordic
and it
fjords.
Suits him down on the ground as he swans about in his smoking jacket.
In his silk smoking jacket. It should be said at this point that basically, as far as I can tell, the propaganda for this film...
It must have also had amazing heating for just to have a silk...
I know, they're in the North Atlantic.
It would have been bloody freezing.
On an iron ship.
Yeah, and it's just his smoking jacket. This'll do!
Is it good for a smoking jacket at dinner? Basically, the propaganda of this film is trying to make out that the Royal Navy is an absolute laugh. Whether you're below decks or in the officers' mess, you couldn't hope for a jollier set of fellows to bunk up with.
Jesus Christ.
Anyway, the job of this cruiser is to be part of a Royal Navy... What do you call a collection of ships?
Fleet?
That's a bit too big.
Oh.
What's smaller than a fleet?
A flotilla?
A flotilla of... destroyers and cruisers who are to accompany this convoy from Eastern Europe back to Britain. And as we discover, this convoy is filled with immigrants who like a good sing-song, don't they, Simon?
Of course. I mean, this is again when it gets back to very, very dated, on the nose. I mean, come on, man. Like, everyone's like, you're basically waiting for one of them to turn around in a big bearskin hat and start singing If I Was a Rich Man. It's just ridiculous.
Well, that's basically what they're doing. When we first meet all these very downtrodden immigrants, is they're singing a very mournful Eastern European dirge, aren't they?
Yeah.
And then one of them pipes up with a much jollier version, and we meet...
And they eat him. That's not true.
Jesus Christ! And we meet Lucy Armitage, who's part of this fleeing group of immigrants. It's 1940. It's really interesting that the films we've watched so far from these very early years of the war have really focused on this flow of people, immigrants fleeing from the Nazis
yeah.
or the Russians at this point.
True. Soviets.
Oh, God damn it. Lucy Armitage, who is the woman in this love triangle, is on this boat, right?
Yeah.
So this boat is commanded by the most amazingly brilliant captain on the high seas. Why is he the most brilliant captain on the high seas, Simon?
No idea.
Because he's Yorkshire.
Oh, my God.
If you're going to talk about Norfolk...
Is he Yorkshire?
Oh, is he York? He says by gum at one point.
And, of course, he's a right salty sea dog.
Yeah,
He's got the perfect cap, he's got the pipe, he's got the juice and lot, hasn't he?
All he's missing is a wooden leg and a parrot.
Yeah, it's true.
He is the captain of the Seaflower.
And he's in love with the Seaflower.
Oh, that... Yeah. The Seaflower is the finest ship on the seven seas, if you ask him. And he's got a salty dog first mate as well.
He has.
And basically, the captain of the Seaflower doesn't want to join the convoy because that's for, you know, that's for girls.
Yeah, no, it's weird.
Only real men sail out on the sea by themselves, and he promptly gets immediately accosted by a U-boat.
Yeah, it's very not a wise move by Captain and Yorkshire.
And he's like, oh, it's all right, I'll handle this fella. He goes, como usted español? And the Nazi's like, nine. They're shouting at each other across the sea, you understand. And he's basically, in his cod Spanish, is like, mio captaino of Spanish ship. Ship to Espanol. And the Germans go, right, you're fine, on your way. But it's a trap, Simon.
Of course it's a trap, because he says quick to the other lads on the ship, it's like, put the flag out. And they put the flag out.
It's a Norwegian
one.
They don't even have a flag of Spain. They're useless. Anyway, it's a trap, because what the Germans have in store is to capture this merchant navy vessel filled with immigrants and use it as bait to draw the destroyers off the convoy, where the Deutschland pocket battleship will destroy them. And the U-boats can take out the now unprotected convoy is generally the plot that
it's
I got from that.
It's a dastardly, maniacal Nazi plan.
And do you know why it's dastardly and maniacal? Because the German... the German naval officer who's captured the beautiful Yorkshire ship, the Seaflower...
Yeah.
On being told, right, we have been rumbled by the British... What am I doing? That's terrible. That's like Russian. He goes, this is the only reason I'm doing this, dear German listeners, is because this is how they sound in this film. This isn't how German people sound. I hasten to add.
Yeah, that's quite important. On three, two, one.
Jawohl. Yes, perhaps you will be left on the ship by yourself. And when we torpedo it, you will have a very quick death. And he locks all the immigrants below decks. And now he's on his own ship and he's like, destroy them. But you're not going to get one over a Yorkshireman that quickly. And he breaks out of his very, not very well locked cabin. Takes over the vessel. And he's saved by the arrival of a... of some British destroyers who have come to collect him because he's being tardy and not joining the convoy. And the Germans, they beat to hasty a cheat because they're just cowards. It is really that bad. And unfortunately, in the middle of all this is poor Anton Driffing as a U-boat commander who's like, can I sink them now? And he's like, nine, we must run away. So, what has been discovered, this is the trauma, is the dashing...
The trauma is the film.
How dare you!
Yeah, that's the trauma.
How dare you! Lieutenant Cranford, when finding out that not only is the Seaflower stranded, But they're getting these trick messages from the Nazis who have taken over saying, we are sinking, quickly come help us. There are children and women, they are dying. So he goes, all right, we've got to go save them. And the very mean Captain Armitage says, no, we can't leave the convoy, it's against the rules. So Lieutenant Cranford actually sends out a message to say, please go save the Seaflower, which is what happens, they're saved. But for that despicable bit of underhanded going above the captain's head, he gets locked up, doesn't he?
Yeah, banged up.
Banged up, locked up.
Doesn't he get banged up in his really nice suite?
Yeah,
though?
So he's not really locked up. He's now in the nicest suite on the high seas.
I could do time in a Savoy, do you know what I mean? No problem.
Making gin martinis and smoking in his smoking jacket. But the reason that he goes to all these lengths to save the Seaflower is not because it's a proud vessel of Yorkshire, which should have been enough, to be honest.
Wait for it, for massive coincidence number two.
Is that the ex-wife of the captain that he stole from the captain and then abandoned in Singapore is Lucy Armitage, who is on this vessel of very basically sad-looking immigrants singing mournful songs.
Would you believe it?
So she gets brought on board when she finally gets rescued, and she goes to see the captain in his not as glamorous suite, and he says, it's frightfully good to see you. And she goes, well, it's marvellously good to see you too. And he says, well, one fly in the ointment is that David...
Paraphrasing here.
David Cranford's on board too. And she's like, oh my. And he's like, yes, I thought you might like to know that. And she goes, well, poor David, he was always getting himself in trouble. And he's like, how dare you defend that bounder? And she says, what? Defend the bounder? No, it was me that left him. And all comes out. Is Lieutenant Cranford didn't dump her in Singapore. No. She left him.
So that she's dumped both of them.
What a...
Wait. Cut. So she's dumped both of them, basically.
And basically taken off by herself for adventures unknown.
Yeah. She's an independent lady in a time when there wasn't many independent ladies, basically.
Yeah. God bless her. And so you see Captain Armitage having to quickly reevaluate and goes, oh, I say, I might have been a bit rash with Lieutenant Cranford. Unlock him at once, which is handy because we're suddenly plunged into brilliant, epic levels of naval combat. Come on, there's nothing else
epic,
to say about
epic this. Levels of model making.
They're good models, though, aren't
Some
they?
Some of them are. Some of them are.
I don't believe it. So, anyway, there you go. That's the weird love triangle in this. And the plucky, misunderstood Lieutenant Cranford ultimately saves the day, because what happens is the Deutschland, it's a very, very, very sad moment. The Seaflower, the Royal Navy demands the Seaflower sink itself because it's already damaged.
What, Seaflower?
Oh, I've been master of this ship for 25 years. I'm not going to sink it. She's like my own child. And he decides not to sink her because a fog bank comes in. He goes, I can slip away, make it to Hull, no problem. And he doesn't make it to Hull. He runs literally, if we believe the very weird rear projection, through the fog. He runs slap bang into the middle of the pocket battleship Deutschland. And what the plucky Yorkshire captain does is he, on his little toot toot, ship horn, is he Morse codes the name Deutschland. Yep. So the British cruisers hear it and they're prepared and they know that what's happening, this trap has been sprung. And the Deutschland doesn't like that. And the other most really stereotypical Nazi, who is the commander of the Deutschland, says, you must sink her at once, fire all guns. Yeah, she is a plucky ship, but now she is sunk. I mean, it's really like that. It is such
and
levels
really of... Because, like, Captain Yorkshire gets the first mate killed here. It's complete...
They both die.
I know, but he gets him killed. It's complete negligence.
No, but he's Yorkshire, so he's all right. So he's a...
a terrible man.
How dare you?
Well, no, think about it. So not only has he gone off course, and... At one point...
He's refused to follow every rule.
Yeah, every rule in the book during wartime in a convoy. I mean, he's the worst seaman on earth.
But he actually ends up alerting the Royal Navy to the presence of this pocket battleship. But there's a discussion amongst all the Royal Navy cruisers, and they go, look, we've got to stay in formation with the convoy until we get to Britain. But the plucky Captain Armitage isn't having that. He's like, no, we will have at it with this pocket battleship, even though we're a light cruiser. And he basically charges her, because he obviously can't fire his guns because they're way out of range. The very evil Nazi commander of the pocket battleship Deutschland is like, fire all guns. He says, oh, this is very typical of the British Navy. They foolhardy run at us, thinking they could defeat us, the mighty Germans. How silly. Open fire.
God.
Am I wrong, though?
No, that's exactly what happens.
It's exactly what happens. Anyway, the plucky British cruiser is blown to bits, but there's still one gun working, and that's manned by Lieutenant Cranford, of course,
mm-hmm.
who is basically, they've lost communications with their guns, so they're having to do it by relay, with possible best death in there. And
yes,
there's a direct hit on the magazine. So Lieutenant Cranford volunteers to go into the magazine and open the sluices so it floods and isn't on fire anymore. And he gets a very nasty burn on his face, which looks a bit fatal.
It does. And it is fatal. It is. So poor old bugger comes out of the magazine, which is probably the best part of the film. And he crawls out after opening the sluices and, as Dan was saying, is pretty badly burnt up. And he sits there crouching down, and Shorty, one of the other officers, who's been talking to him through the film about the love of his life and how much he wants to marry her.
Yeah.
But every time Shorty's told her, told the lieutenant about her, she sounds like a bit of a wrong one. Just like, oh yeah, she's a bit of a party girl. She's got a few other blokes and she's not decided. And his last words are sort of like, oh, Shorty. This is paraphrasing. Like,
I've got the exact quote.
Oh, have you? Go for it.
Of course I've got the exact quote. It says, if I was you. So Shorty's told him about this girlfriend who's an actress, and you could see Lieutenant Cranford's like, oh, that's not good.
No.
You don't want to be dating an actress. And this poor fellow, this young chap, is deeply in love with her. She's the most marvellous girl in the world. I think I shall marry her. And so Lieutenant Cranford's last words are, if I was you, I wouldn't marry that sort of a girl.
Great, really deep.
Great advice, though. I mean, you know. He'll keep that with him, that young fella.
That is true. And there he goes. That's the end of John Clements in that film. But it's all, you know, his entire role is about redemption, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, from the flash Harry dandy at the beginning to sacrificing himself for the greater good, as all British men would be seen to do in 1940.
Yeah, of course. You know? He wasn't the bounder after all.
No.
He was actually a good man, and he dies sacrificing his life for the sake of the ship that has somehow miraculously survived a close encounter with a pocket battleship.
I mean, it's been a strange whole week for him, really, what with the bizarre love triangle et al.
I know, really odd. He's been arrested in his luxurious suite. Just some of the quotes from this, because they are so good. This is actual quotes. Before, I was doing a sort of gratuitous impersonation of what the Nazis in this film are like. But the stereotypical Nazi who wants to sink this beautiful seaflower with all the immigrants on it says, when challenged, you know, but you can't sink us. We don't have enough boats for all these passengers. And he goes,
But you can't do that. She's full of passengers. I've got no boats for half of them.
That is also unfortunate, Captain. You should either carry more boats or less passengers.
He also then goes on to say, when being challenged, there's a brilliant bit where Lucy Armitage says to this horrible Nazi captain, she says, a young naval officer once said, and she quotes basically the Navy prayer, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And Yorkshire captain joins in and he starts quoting it as well. And she says, that was spoken by the greatest man that ever lived, Winston Churchill. To which the Nazi replies,
no greater man than Hitler's ever lived.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
My other favourite line for stereotypical Brit is when Captain Armitage discovers from his ex-wife that she didn't actually get abandoned in Singapore, but then, after dumping him, dumped David Cranford and took off for places unknown. He says, rather miffed, I just don't understand you people.
You people.
You people.
Does that mean people that are younger than him?
People that gad about doing things. Other favourite lines, the guy who, one of the chirpy chappies, who's a gunner.
Right.
When they're charging at the Deutschland and the first salvos are fired at them, he goes, reminds me of Guy Fawkes, don't it? Other great lines, Simon. Obviously, the British don't have really much of a naval air force at this point, so they've just got these little biplanes that are launched off the ships on a sort of catapult, right? Yeah. So,
not the best job in the world, is what we were saying. One of them being gunned by a battleship.
Well, this tiny little biplane takes on the Deutschland to try and buy the Captain Armitage's ship enough time to get in close enough to fire their guns. And they take it on with a machine gun the back of the biplane.
All right.
And the machine gunner gets hit in the arm. And he goes, oh, I'm sorry, Phil.
Oh, yeah.
I seem to have been hit.
I'll take you back for a nice cup of tea.
And the pilot says, oh, let's head home. I'll buy you a nice cup of tea.
Yeah, I'll buy you one. It's just surely the tea's free.
You would think after surviving near death, you'd at least get a free tea.
Free cuppa.
Best Death Awards. So there's this relay chain of sailors, isn't there, Simon?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of basically calling out ranges and direction and all that sort of thing. And you see the camera pan across them as they go, everything's under control. Everything's under control. I don't know why that's a message. Everything is definitely not under control because the whole ship's on fire. Bodies are everywhere. Everything's under control. And then we see a shell land. And just as this fella's about to pass on the message, he gets hit. And his chum comes up and goes, you all right, sunshine? And he goes,
I'm all right. Everything's under control.
And dies.
That is the best death award.
Do you think?
I think that's better than Cranford's.
What about Yorkshire captain of the Seaflowers crushed by his own steering wheel?
Crushed by his own hubris.
Well,
that's what that is.
Possibly.
No, I think everything's under control is the one. And stereotypical Nazi for me is just Anton Driffin just because he's in it.
I've just seen another note I had that I missed.
Oh, go on.
When the German captain comes on board the captured Yorkshire ship, the Seaflower, and he says,
Heil Hitler! I'll my fanny.
Yeah. What do you give it out of five?
Four.
Now, your own propaganda about the film is finished. What do you seriously give Convoy out of five?
I'm tempted to give it five.
This is a wind-up. You're just doing it to wind me up. I don't believe you think it's a five at all.
Ladies and gents, this really is a rip-roaring yarn. Once you get past the weird love triangle, which is more 1960s than 1940s, it's really good battle stuff. It's exactly the kind of thing I love. Explosions, great last words, heroic deaths, stereotypical Nazis, high seas drama. All right, I'll give it a three.
A three?
Yeah.
Right, so you talked yourself down by two. I'm going to give it a one.
Oh, my Lord!
I'm going to give it a one.
Cries of outrage!
And I can only be thankful that I will never have to see it again. And if anyone wants to win this...
No, we're not going to give this one away.
Well, you want to keep it?
Not only do I want to keep it, but once a year, Simon and I are going to get together.
I'm never watching it again.
And drink vast quantities of beer and watch it.
No, we'll find... There are thousands of war films. I never have to see this one again.
Oh,
sorry.
That seems a bit harsh. Most stereotypical Brit?
Oh, half... All of them.
The entire officer class.
Well, no. The entire officer class, as in... the upper echelons of power of Britain.
Yeah.
The people under the deck as the street urchins made good.
Yeah.
And then the Yorkshireman. I mean, he's got them all.
I'm going to go with the Yorkshireman. He's so amazing. And we've not had a stereotypical Yorkshireman yet. So if you think I'm going to let that opportunity go by. Imagine if he was from Norfolk. We'd still be hearing about it. You'd have visited his house. You'd have talked to his ancestors.
I don't think people from Norfolk are allowed to be in films like this.
I don't think people in Norfolk are allowed to be.
Oi!
So
I'll go with that as well then.
All right. Yeah, brilliant. So honestly, folks, we had to buy this off the internet. What do you mean? It's really not that bad. It is so not as bad as Simon is making out. One is really harsh, I think.
No,
I mean,
it's not.
We gave Confessions of a Nazi Spy one.
I gave it a half.
Well, to say this film's only half a point better than Confessions of a Nazi Spy, which might possibly be the worst film ever made by man or woman.
Quite possible. Well, I don't know if it's the worst, but it's definitely the most boring. Isn't it? It really is boring. But I found this
at least
I found this really boring, and you made me watch it twice for your own negligence.
made him watch it twice.
So maybe my one is through anger. So
yeah, I'll give it's a bit petulant.
One and a half.
Oh my word! But if you can find Convoy, not only do I think is it an important film with regards to the history, because I think it might be the first ever film about the battle for the Atlantic, but there's some really eccentric performances in it. There's some great battle scenes, and I'm giving it 5.
Oh my God, this is ridiculous.
It's okay. Where our grading system completely goes out the window. So, next up, ladies and gents, we're going to stay in the North Atlantic with the brilliant 49th Parallel.
Starring Laurence Olivier.
Leslie Howard, Raymond Massey, Glynis Johns, and directed by...
Michael Powell.
And a...
Is Ralph Richardson not in that? I'm pretty sure he's in that.
He's not.
Oh.
It's another Powell-Pressburger film.
Great, okay.
What was our first one?
Battle of the River Plate.
So that's going to be great.
It should be.
Simon is very ready not to be doing posh toffs in black and white. He can't wait till we're in the into the vast open spaces of Eastern Europe.
I never thought I'd say it, but I can't wait until the Nazis invade the Brest Fortress, basically. And then, because then we've got all the Eastern Front movies.
Fortress of War, what a film.
Exactly.
What a film. I know we've spent 2 years basically promising you it's going to get really good.
But it's about to get really good.
We just need to get rid of the British for a little while. We need the Russians in and we need the Yanks in.
Yeah.
Quickly, please. All right. So there we go, ladies and gents. 49th Parallel. Thank you for listening once again. Also, a very, very, very strong thanks. Because guess what landmark we passed, Simon, with our last podcast? We passed 4,000 listens.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I mean, that's pretty good, isn't it?
Pretty good. We should set up a Patreon page and start paying ourselves. Do you think that'll happen?
No.
No, neither do I.
No, why would anyone pay for this? However, having said that, dear, sweet, lovely listeners that aren't mortified and offended and are switching off in their droves because of my stereotypical imitations of Germans, Americans... British.
Everyone.
Canadians.
I mean, you've probably lost Yorkshire today.
Impossible. Once you're a Yorkshireman, you're always a Yorkshireman. So, and for those of you who are still devout listeners, please, on your whatever you do, your listen on Apple Podcasts or whatever medium you listen to us through, please, if you could all leave a review. On those sites...
Be careful what you wish for there, Dan. As long as it's nice.
Yeah. Don't leave bad reviews, obviously. That would not be helpful. But if you can all leave some 5-star reviews for us, if you believe we're worth 5 stars. I mean, I thought this film was worth 5 stars, so that tells you all you need to know, doesn't it?
Now, that would be amazing. That would be hugely appreciated.
In the meantime, you have been listening to...
The Foxhole Companion!
Hello. Unbelievable.
Sorry. I got my final yawn out of the way. That's my convoy. Okay. Right.
Right, here we go.
Right.